Very good afternoon and welcome to On The Radar News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I am now joined in studio by analyst Vitalio Angola. Good afternoon, Vitalio, and welcome to On The Radar News Analysis.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So today, of course, we're talking about, does development follow people or do people institute development, using UIS and Ongwediva as a case study? Vitalio, can you get right into it for us, please?
Okay. Thank you for having me. I had traveled to UIS maybe 2 weeks ago, and one thing that struck me is that there is no tar road between UIS and the adjacent towns. The adjacent towns of Usakos, Omaruru, and Korikas. So my question is, does development follow people or do people follow development? Why I ask this question, I give Ongwediva as an example. Ongwediva in 1992 was a settlement, and they proclaimed it a town, and because they had a national budget, capital money was able to flow to the point where Ongwediva might actually become a city, or a city if it joins up with Oshakati.
Okay.
So my question is, UIS, which is a resource-based town, until today, it does not have a tarred road. Now my question is, how did that come about? UIS, if you can give the history of UIS in 1921, that's when the UIS tin mine started. And then somewhere after 2010, when the tin prices went down, the mine closed. But now they have now a new investor who is called Andrada, and now they have actually come back and they are doing investment in the town. But the question is, why are there roads in the north linking different towns and villages, but a resource-based town like UIS does not have similar?
Interesting. Now, you spoke about earlier when we were discussing about tin being mined in UIS. Can you kindly get more into detail about that?
Okay. Let me just give you an example. 1921. But I'll give you also the example of Ghana. Ghana is a cocoa based country. There is cocoa every day being shipped to Switzerland, and they use this cocoa to make chocolates. Until today, even if you go on the NSA, Namibia imports a certain amount in the millions of chocolates. But the extractive industry that was done in Ghana was that the Ghanaian people will become the source of the natural resource, which is cocoa. They will send it to Europe, and then Europe will process it into chocolates, and those chocolates will be sold on international markets. And then in Namibia, we can say the same with UIS, that all the tin is being extracted from these communities, and that tin is being processed in other countries. So is it a issue of international development, or is it an issue of national development, or is it an issue of town development, whereby the town councils cannot get sufficient money from the national budget to develop a simple thing as a road? And when we talk about roads, we are not only talking about this black thing that you see on the surface. It is a facilitator of economic development.
I hear you. You spoke about Walter Rodney's book as well. And of course, you touched on the Ghanaian story again. Also getting to his book, what actually he spoke about in terms of Africa's economy?
Yeah. Walter Rodney has got a book. I was gifted this book by my uncle Tate Makua. And it's called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, we hear a lot about foreign direct investment, but the question of foreign direct investment, does it really help the community on the ground? So what Walter Rodney posited in this book is this extractive nature of our relationship with the global market. I think there's been a lot of talk, I think, with our Minister of Mines and Energy. He's also the Deputy Prime Minister, Natango Ithete, where he speaks about 51-49% ownership when it comes to resources.
Mm-hmm.
Other people will say, okay, it will chase investors out. But for me, if investors are going to raise money and they're going to put money into a mine, for me, it means that the investors must be able to take their fair share worth. But the question is when we come to corporate social responsibility.
Yeah.
Should, these corporates like Andrada, Oystein Mine, be able to extract from a community without building that community, without building a road? And in Namibia, not anybody can build a road. It's only the National Road Authority.
That is also with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Also with the roads contractor company who can build a road. But the money that is gained from taxes,
mm,
should it not be to build roads in that community? In that community where resources are being extracted. So when it comes to the question of corporate social responsibility, should corporate social responsibility be limited to books, giving a book, giving desks, or should these corporates actually build sports fields, libraries, schools, roads, water infrastructure? Those are the questions we have to ask ourselves.
Mm. Petalio, how is the situation of water at Uis now?
The current situation, I don't know, but I remember when I traveled two years ago, when the company started, there is a community activist. His name is Jimmy Avaseb. So this community activist was complaining. He was lamenting about the you know, mining is very water intensive,
mm-hmm,
so the water table, it actually lowered, so there was not sufficient water being pumped into the community, and then the hostel had to close, and a lot of the children
hostel.
Yes, the school hostel,
mm-hmm,
and a lot of the children who go to the school actually reside in the hostel, and this hostel learner said, no, at the end of the day, we cannot go to school. As one girl put it to me, we are on our monthly cycle, and as learners, we cannot even bath to go to school. And this speaks to huge corporations coming to Africa, extracting resources and not building on the infrastructure. How does a big company, which is on the London Stock Exchange, start competing with water with a community of Uis?
Mm.
How?
Good question. Now, does Namibia have a skewed development in favor of the northern people?
I would argue and say yes. In Namibia, we've got the issue of tribalism that pops up. I think you saw in Petseba where people were saying, oh, this ethnic group must go out. And people see on TV, people hear on radio, people see on Gwediva, people see Oshakati.
Mm.
They see how those towns have developed. And I'll give you the example of even on Gwediva settlement in 1992, Uis settlement from 1921. Who facilitated the growth of Ongwediva. It's just central government. People will argue local government, but it is budget that the local government is coming, getting from the central government. And then you look at towns like Oranjemund has not grown. Wafishbe has grown to a certain extent. Luderitz has not grown.
Rospina.
Yes. And then these are the towns where the resources are coming from. And then I give an example of Johannesburg. Johannesburg, Ekurhuleni, the city of gold. That is where the people got gold. Today, Johannesburg is the financial capital of Africa. How come Owis is not the tin capital of Africa? How come Oranjemund is not the diamond capital of Africa? How come Wafish Bay is not the fish capital of Africa? But then again, we can point it to the labor system, with the native labor system, where a lot of men from the northern part came to work in the southern parts of the country, in the mines, in the fishing industry, A, B, and C. If you know the history of the ruling party, they started protesting in Wafish Bay. So some people from the north will argue that, okay, we came here, we worked, and then obviously we built where we are. So it comes back to the question, does development follow people, or do people
institute
development? It's a very fundamental question, which I believe your listeners should actually engage. We must have a national dialogue. And has there been unfair treatment of people from where resources are extracted and where it's building? You can see, Happy, I'm not lying to you. Go to Oshakati and even look at Oshakati 20 years before or 30 years before, and look at Oshakati today. Look at Ongwediva 1992, look at it today. Look at Oranjemund 1992, look at it today. Look at Uwis, which is a tragic example, and look at it today. It's not a similar story. So even the people who are overlooking our national budget, do they only build where they are from, or do they take the whole national context into account?
Could you say perhaps maybe it's lack of the councillors or the governors in the particular regions who are perhaps not reaching out to the central government to say, this is what we want to develop, and perhaps that they are not doing that compared to others in other places? Could that be something that we could pinpoint and explore also?
Maybe you can argue like that, but I think it's also about representation. If you look at Kunene region, and if you look at into the hinterland of Erongo region, UDF territories, who is UDF, Opuo, PDM, formerly DTA, Korihas, UDF. So they are not represented in parliament. And but they don't have also access to the national budget. But then also some of these places like Uwis is still a settlement. It's not even proclaimed a town. I'm not an expert in government infrastructure, but I know that once you proclaim a town, you get certain a budget. Your budget becomes bigger. So it might be also an issue of representation, whereby you are not represented in the national dialogue. So when the budget is being administered, you are not getting your sufficient share of the budget. Do I blame the locals? I can't really say I'll blame the locals, because empowerment comes with information. We have this thing called now the National Youth Fund. People are already arguing that it favors people in the urban areas who've got access to cell phones, access to internet, access to information. I was at Owis. We have these, what you call it, small-scale artisanal miners. They are saying, if I could just have a jackhammer, I could get this tin out of the out of the ground, and I can sell it to the company. But now I'm still using my traditional methods. So these are the things we have to ask ourselves. Not only skewed development in favor of the north, but is there a skewed development in favor of the urban areas? And then we see that there's so much pressure on Windhoek already, where people are struggling for rent and stuff.
Yeah.
If we develop our rural areas, it means that
we significantly reduce urbanization.
Yes, and we create employment there.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But what implementations would you offer in this regard? What implementations perhaps and suggestions or strategies that we could help mitigate this way moving forward?
I don't know, but what I can advise is to have a national dialogue whereby even in the mainstream that we are allowed or to voice our frustration. A person from Uwis should be allowed to say, no, I feel that the development only goes to Awambo. And then the people in government should be able to say, no, as a matter of fact, we develop where the people are. If you were there before 1990, there was this school in Gibeon.
Mm-hmm.
This school, it was run by the former deputy Prime Minister Hendrik Witbooi. He's from Gibeon. So a lot of the children from Ovamboland used to come to Gibeon for education. And somebody would argue that even when all our funders are giving money to set up educational institutions, that they do it in the populated areas. So now that already skews development, because you had a good school which was in the south, it's produced a lot of dynamic leaders, but now you are taking the whole budget now to the north.
Mm.
So people in the north will argue that here is the population, but I cannot still fathom that there is a road going from Onyati to Onkumbula, and then in Onkumbula there is only two secondary schools, a clinic, a police station, and a councillor's office. Uwis has a tin mine. What justifies a road to be built from Onyati to Onkumbula, but not from Omaruru to Uwis, or from Uwis to Yusakos? That is a question that government planners, I think, have to answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Peter Lis, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Analysis.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
Mm.
Nice.
My sister.
And of course, there you had it, insights of with Vitalio Angule, analyst Vitalio Angule. Now, should you also want to contribute to this news analysis, 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Kindly dial in. And for now, let's pause right here, take a trip to the marketplace. But you know, we'll be back with more right here.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081 270 3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. The World Population Day was celebrated today in Katutura at the Namibia College of Open Learning by UNFPA, the Ministry of Education, the National Planning Commission, and young community members were also present. Now, this coincides with the July launch of the 2025 population report by UNFPA. Now, speaking to us now is Jane Fury, Speaker of the Children's Parliament of Namibia.
Society recognizes young people the knowledge of their bodies, denies them the power to shape their future. As students invited guests, ladies and gentlemen, members of the media, and fellow young leaders, as Speaker of the Children's Parliament, I stand before you today with a profound conviction that true empowerment begins with awareness, dignity, and equality. Empowering young people to create the families they want in a fair and local world. We cannot afford to ignore three fundamental pillars: fertility awareness, sexual and reproductive health, and rights and gender equality. Knowledge of one's body is not optional. It is essential. When young people understand their reproductive health, they can make informed decisions. This is not just a matter of biology, it is a matter of opportunity, of breaking cycles of poverty, of ensuring that every child is born into a family they are able to nurture them from. These United Provinces, they are basic human rights. Access to young and family planning, safe childbirth, and accurate information gives young people the tools to protect their well-being. But beyond access, there must be dignity. No young girl should feel ashamed of her body. No young boy should feel left out of a conversation. And no young person should be denied services because of where they live or who they are. This is not only a call to government and policymakers, it is a call to us too. We must demand inclusion in decision making, raise our voices against stigma, and hold ourselves accountable for building a.
And now let's get into a discussion with us with Dwight Links. A very good afternoon to you, Dwight Links, and thank you for joining us once again on the Reader News Analysis.
Thank you once again, Happy, and welcome to the listeners here for the On the Radar. And obviously, as we are battling towards the weekend, I don't want to make any hints or suggestions, but you know what? It's a Thursday. But once again, good afternoon.
Yeah. Now, World Population Day was celebrated today, which coincided with the July launch of the 2025 population report by UNFPA. Dwight, what did this report cover?
Well, specifically, you know, and I'm not just not highlighting what the three speakers are tapping into, but there was one overall theme that all three of them cited.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, so that the listeners just can recognize, it was the Deputy Executive Director of Ministry of Education, Edda Bon, the representative for the United Nations Population Fund Agency in Namibia, that's Madam Goldson, as well as also the Speaker of the Youth Parliament, mm-hmm, or the, mm-hmm, Children's Parliament here in Namibia, that being the young lady by the name of Petey. All of them obviously had the youth in mind in terms of the discussion, in terms of their particular speeches, that the listeners just heard of. But the report cites a particular aspect in terms of looking at the future, which is also looking at what role the youth or future, you know, future adults that would come from the youth of today would be participating in. The major theme there was, Happy, that the global population faces a workforce crisis, specifically because of lower birth rates.
Mm.
Many people don't think about this when they look at a developmental angle towards, you know, where your population would be 25 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now. And for the better part of the first 6 months of this year, there's been many discussions happening about when will be the peak the human population peak on the planet,
mm-hmm,
specifically where would the growth areas be? Africa is obviously always pointed towards being the biggest concentration, that I have the biggest concentration. You would have heard those sentences or those statements saying Africa will have the largest youth contingent in the world by a certain time.
Yeah.
Africa will have the largest, you know, various other particular angles that speaks towards workforce, youth, birth rate, ability to live still on the continent, skills development, all that. As opposed to many other parts of the world that are actually starting to see declines, meaning some countries have reached peak, and they are now starting to have lesser children. Or it's just, what they call it is the actual replacement theory is birth rates versus death rates. So you look at how many people per 1,000 people die per month or per year, and you look at how many children are born per 1,000 people or per women, for a specific year or a specific month. So they balance the two particular statistics up to each other to see, okay, you've got so many people passing away in a year. How many children were born in a year to replace the people that passed away? And that's the basic statistic that they all start off from. Many, what they call it, policymakers and planners.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at, where will these children be 25 years from now, and what services should you have, or what things should you have implemented?
Yeah.
Now, Happy, here's the interesting thing. Obviously, you know, the discussions that were obviously taking place, there were a lot were, that's not from the three speakers, from what the listeners heard, was obviously based upon, how do we need to look after the youth for the future? Much of it was centered upon the aspects of unplanned pregnancies, support functions in societies, as well as also discussions of, you know, what support bases are there for the youth in future?
Yeah.
The current scenario today, of, you know, what the report cites, the current scenario of what the report cites is that people don't want to have children because it is expensive to have children.
Exactly.
The facilitating services and functions around establishing a household, even just if you're a single parent, housing is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Transport is expensive. Things like basic cost of living, which is also all of that included.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this means you having money during the month to buy food, to pay for other particular services, or just to respond to an emergency. Let's, for example, say a child becomes sick.
Mm-hmm.
All those particular services and all those particular functions, which forms part of, in some cases you can call it consumer price index, but we put it at the cost of living scenario, because this is based upon the human and it's not based upon the business selling to the human. So CPI is what the business tries to sell to you.
Yeah.
And you, the human, you are looking at cost of living.
Okay.
The cost of living discussion, unfortunately, Happy, has become a major theme for the past 3 years since COVID, because it obviously exposed so many particular
realities.
Let's go with realities. That's the best way to put it. So the realities on the ground have been a lot more services would be needed to avoid something like a COVID happening again.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of particular investment in protective, in social welfare systems would be needed.
Mm-hmm.
You still see some countries still persisting 5 years after COVID with social welfare programs. So the theme then, the report then answers that particular theme. If Namibia wants young people in schools, they want athletes for the future, they want students on universities, they want what you call it, future politicians and policymakers and bankers, industry leaders and business people, there should be a scenario of taking a serious look at how do you instill or install an aspect of a safe, I can't say conducive environment, but the environment should be one that cost of living is actually a minimal impediment.
Mm. Interesting.
We can still ask some more questions. There's a lot more because the whole theme of the reports is just around, can people today have children? Can they afford to have children?
Yeah.
Can they afford to have a place to stay, meaning accommodation, and are they able to do or access jobs, obviously with the threat that AI is posing in the jobs of the future as well.
Yeah. What's of course we've heard about this three young people, but then what are most young people saying in terms of this? What are their sentiments?
Well, just to cite, and the UNFPA guys already did that in their report, because obviously they are based in either in Switzerland or in the US. they obviously went and spoke to various people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they spoke to fellow developing countries like Namibia. So mm-hmm. they went in one case to Sri Lanka. In another scenario, they went to South America. And obviously, all these zones are similar to like where Namibia finds itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they spoke to young women and they spoke to young men even. Many of the respondents cited in that report said they can't even date because they obviously know that the fear of having a child,
mm-hmm.
the moment you have a child is the moment instantaneously,
yeah.
you know that much of your resources are geared towards protecting and looking after the child.
Yeah.
Many people obviously would have different opinions and views about that. Many cases, some women first want to achieve studies, achieve a career,
yeah.
in order to be self-sustainable,
Mm-mm-mm.
because that's the reasons why we all go to school, is to achieve some level of self-sustainability.
Before you can even start a family.
Exactly, or you even can start dating.
Mm.
And these are many of the particular fears that are highlighted. And that's like literally happy in the first five pages of that report.
Mm-hmm.
It's like highlighted there in terms of they show all these testimonies of young people, men and women across the world.
Interesting.
So at great length, they talk about, you can hear the underlying theme, which has been something we've heard since we were all on primary school. Be sure to look after, protect yourself from, unwanted pregnancies.
Yeah.
Or other severe scenarios, obviously. But in many cases, it's a scenario of, how do you balance what the youth's ambitions are,
mm-hmm.
their fears in terms of the threat that AI poses, and in the event that things like a pregnancy comes along, a child has to be born,
mm-hmm.
are the relevant installations around them for having access to housing, having access to transport, having the peace of mind element in terms of knowing that they at least have a job that can pay for these things. And those are the particular fears that they all stagger up based from pregnancy,
yeah.
from birth rate, but they all stack up against the two humans at the core of this. So in most cases, a young mother and an unborn child, because they need to look to the future. Just to cite and to end off specifically, one of the worrying things specifically is that comes through from the report itself is that they cite here that one in four people in the world are living in a country that has seen its population already peak, meaning it has reached its peak level,
yeah.
and the highest or largest density of that nation's population. And that the particular report also cites that you will start seeing declines in many countries. So they've reached their level.
Mm-hmm.
Now you just need to see, will they have more children from there?
Mm-hmm.
Will it increase
mm-hmm.
or will it actually start petering downwards?
Mm-hmm.
Where they state global fertility rates are declining. The human population is projected to reach its crest within the century and then to fall. They take this from another UN agency, because this population fund report was based upon another UN agency statistics, the demographics, UN demographics and something agency.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at birth rates, death, that agency looks at birth rates, death rates and other particular demographics. And they note here that all these people specifically are looking towards what is the future in their countries, which will be the same particular thing. We still need to tap into Namibia, because I just came from an event where young people were being entertained with song and dance, which had obviously a message of saying, you know, how to have a supportive system in base mm-hmm. in households mm-hmm. in Namibia to help a unplanned pregnancy
mm-hmm.
or a young woman expecting a child.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more on a theme of, you know, the optics. It was more of saying, you know, this is the overall theme you should subscribe to. But we obviously know, like you said, the realities tend to be way different. Yeah,
exactly.
So that's the particular scenario. And obviously, but the listeners, you know, just need to have that extra context in terms of what was actually in the report
mm.
and the celebration that obviously took place earlier today in terms of, you know, just correlating with each other.
Mm. Thank you, Dwight.
Not a problem.
Okay. Now, Dwight, breaking down what's contained in the UNFPA report, of course, let's give more context as well. Now, the World Population Day marked each year on July 11th. Now, this year, the commemoration in Namibia took place today at Katutura at the Namibia College of Open Learning and was organized by UNPF, the Ministry of Education, as earlier stated, the National Planning Commission and youth participants. It coincides with the July 2025 launch of UNFPA's State of the World Population Report, also known as SWOP or SWOP for 2025. And it's titled, The Real Fertility Crisis, the Pursuit of Reproductive Agency in a Changing World. Now, UNPF's 2025 State of the World Population Report gives a core message on the real crisis, which isn't just about too many. It isn't just about too many or too few people. It's about lack of reproductive agency. Now, globally, many people want children, but face barriers that prevent them from having the number they desire. For instance, a couple may want to have 3 or 4 children, but because of the barriers, maybe lack of proper housing, lack of better financing in order to be able to send all those children to a very good school, then that will be the barrier that will be hindering them from actually having this four number of kids that they desire. Now, based on an extensive UNFPA survey, covered 14 countries together, representing over a third of the global population, and the report has found that 1 in 5 people expect not to have the number of children they want, and major obstacles include high cost of parenthood, which includes housing, childcare, and healthcare, job insecurity and economic precarity, social pressures and unequal domestic responsibilities, particularly affecting women, as women tend to do more domestic responsibilities, even if regardless whether it's a single parent household, which are mostly predominantly dominated by women, or it's a nuclear family consisting of the men and the women. Still, the responsibility majorly in most household centers around the women, and in nowadays world, they still go out and hold down a job equally with their partner or with their husbands, but still the domestic work responsibilities mostly on women. Anxiety about the future in regards to climate change, conflict, social instability. So some of those also are obstacles that hinder them. And also, women cite unequal childcare burdens as a significant, deterrent. And Dr. Natalia Kanem, UNPF's executive director, emphasized that the issue is lack of choice, not desire. Yeah. In other words, the desire is there, but rather the lack of choice. In terms of global launches of the SWOP of 2025 report, which occurred across countries, including Sierra Leone, under the theme Empowering Young People to Create the Families They Want in a Fair and Hopeful World. Zimbabwe, where economic and social barriers are also framed as leading people to have fewer children than desired. Thailand, which stressed the importance of rights and choices and the need for supportive policies, childcare, parental leave, and gender equality. The Philippines, which focused on youth experience and how socioeconomic constraints shape their fertility decisions. And then Iraq, which highlighted that 1 in 5 people feel unable to have their desired number of children, linking that to broader systemic absence of reproductive agency. Now, why perhaps you'll be wondering why this matters for Namibia? Well, youth and reproductive agency in Namibia has predominantly young population. Addressing the ability of young people to make reproductive choices directly impacts their future well-being and development outcomes. Now, also the global 2025 theme, Empowering Young People and the Real Fertility Crisis, likely informed and influenced the messaging, programming, and the design of today's event. Now, the UNFPA presence in national engagement. Namibia's UNPFA office frequently aligns National World Population Day commemorations with global report launches, as seen in earlier years, 2023 in Mariental, 2024 in Zambezi region. So today's gathering suggests a continuation of this pattern. Now, the Katitra event that happened today offers a national platform to translate those global findings into local discussion policy reflection, and perhaps to elevate calls around youth empowerment, reproductive health, and enabling environments for families to form freely. Yeah. Now, with that said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace, but we'll be back shortly before you know it.
Great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Welcome back. Now, of course, today is Thursday, and yesterday we released the Villager e-paper, which is available 3 times a week, and that is tri-weekly, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So you can prepare yourself for tomorrow's edition of the Villager e-paper. Now, remember, it is electronically transferred. In other words, you can get it via your mobile app. All you have to do is send a text message to 08120044. For those of you who have not yet heard about the e-paper or heard about it, but just don't know where to actually go to. Now, one thing I would love to emphasize here is that the Villager e-paper is definitely not a gossip column, but rather an e-paper that focuses on social and economic news, how they impact Namibia, and also how they contribute to Namibia's economy. And sometimes it's sort of like an enlightenment of where Namibia's development agenda can touch on. So make sure that you do grab your copy so that you can educate yourself. If you're somebody who is a fan of well-researched content, well-researched news, then I would definitely vouch and encourage you to subscribe to receive the Villager e-paper. I repeat the number 08120044. Now let's get into the headlines of yesterday's e-paper. 212 megawatts worth of solar panels imported since last year. It also covers headlines on certified seed sector to be established in order to reduce imports. Yeah. And like I told you, of course, in this one, just getting a little bit into detail about it, the University of Namibia will partner up with the Namibia Agronomic Board to establish a certified seed sector to reduce seed imports. Inclusive green financing for Namibia, critical, the Bank of Namibia says. Shanghai Summit seeks to challenge global order. Hybrid solar systems to benefit 3 green schemes. EU, NAM reaffirm ties in trade and multilateral cooperation. Grab your copy and make sure that you don't miss out on tomorrow's release of the e-paper. That is a Friday. But in the meantime, subscribe and read up on Wednesday's e-paper. Now, with that being said, let's take a commercial break. And when we be back, we'll be telling you in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. Right after that, we will be bringing you news beyond the borders. Remember, if you're just tuning in and perhaps you haven't been a regular listener of On The Radar News Analysis, I keep you company up until 14:30. Let's go for a commercial break.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Welcome back, and now we compare the Namibian dollar to other currencies. And just a discussion I had with a friend yesterday, and she was mentioning how Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, but majorly I think Namibia and South Africa are one of the countries with the strongest currency within SADC. I don't want to say Africa because I want to speak, I would be speaking under correction, but yeah, and that gives us much hope and, you know, encouragement to say that our currency is quite among the strongest. And of course, if you don't know, the Namibian dollar is pegged to the South African rand. In other words, it's a one-to-one ratio. Now, let's start off with comparison to the US dollar. One US dollar today equals to 17 Namibian dollars and 79 cents. One Australian dollar today is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 59 cents. One euro is equals to 20 Namibian dollars and 72 cents. £1 sterling is equals to 23 Namibian dollars and 90 cents. One Botswana pula is equals to one Namibian dollar and 24 cents. One Kenyan shilling, on the other hand, is equals to 0.14 Namibian dollars. Now let's move over to trading economics. Now, in regards to trading economics, the North Macedonian economy grew 3.4% year on year in the second quarter of 2025. The highest since the second quarter of 2022, slightly up from a 3.0% expansion in the first quarter, mainly driven by stronger household consumption, which accounts for 68.5% of GDP, rising 3.0% versus the 2.1% in the first quarter. Now, external trade also supported growth, with exports up 9.1% versus 1.2%, and imports increasing 8.0% versus 5.8%. Now, in contrast, government spending fell 1.01% versus 1.1%, while gross capital formation grew at a slower pace of 6.1% versus 18.0%. Now, on a seasonally adjusted quarterly basis, GDP expanded 0.9% in the second quarter, accelerating from 0.5% in the first quarter of 2025. The US-based employers announced 85,979 job cuts in August 2025, up 39% from July and 13% higher than in the same month last year. It is also the highest level in 3 months and the highest for any August month since 2020, with pharmaceutical, financial and technology leading the cuts. So far this year, companies have announced 892,362 job cuts, the highest YTD since 2020. It is up 66% from the 536,441 job cuts announced through the first 8 months of last year, and it's up 17% from the 2024 full year total of the 761,358. After the impact of DOGE on the federal government, employers are citing economic and market factors as the driver of layoffs. The economy of Mozambique contracted by 0.9% year on year in the second quarter of 2025, following a 3.9% slump in the previous 3 month period, keeping the country in recession. Now, the secondary sector led the decline, minus 13.9%, driven by sharp falls in utilities at minus 29.4%, manufacturing at minus -9.4% and construction at -2.2%. Now, the tertiary sector also contributed negatively, shrinking 1.9%, largely due to hotels and restaurants at -11.3%, trade and repair services at -5.9%. Transport, storage and supporting activities and information and communication came in at -3.4%. The primary sector, by contrast, recorded positive growth of 2.9%, driven primarily by the mining industry, which rose 6.8%, and fisheries up 3.9%. Agriculture, livestock, hunting, forestry and related activities expanded by 1.1%. U.S. 10-year government bond yielded decreased to 4.20%, the slowest since August 2025. Now, over the past 4 weeks, U.S. 10-year note bond yield lost 1.20 basis points, and in the last 12 months, it increased 47.30 basis points. And that's what we had for you today in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. Let's pause right here. When we return, we'll be telling you what's making headlines in terms of news beyond the borders.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than The Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Now for news beyond the borders, we start off in South Africa as we begin regionally. Move over to continental news and thereafter international news. Now, South Africa is still talking about Trump tariffs putting a strain on SA's steel industry.
Putting further strain on the already struggling steel industry in the country. This is according to the Steel and Engineering Industries Federation of Southern Africa. They addressed the Rand Mutual Assurance Prevention Conference in Durban. Over 150,000 jobs in the industry are at risk. The industry says the average tariff on exports to the U.S. was just over 2%. However, the new tariff is 50% on certain South African metal and engineering products, as well as steel, aluminium and copper. Joining us for more on this is SABC News reporter Mlondi Khadebe. Good afternoon, Mlondi. Just share with us some of what has come out of that specific conference.
Thank you very much. We are still here at in Durban in this conference where the companies, most of them, are discussing the safety issues in the industry. But the topic that was also highlighted is in relation to U.S. tariffs that they've been, they seems to be crippling the industry, especially the steel industry in South Africa. They are fearing that they might be losing over 150,000 jobs in this industry. But we'll speak to Dr. Jessica just around the issue of safety, and now the companies are complaining about the tariffs.
Yeah, thank you. So we're sitting with a very dire state in terms of what the potential is from a geopolitical and from a financial point of view in the country. And what we would really like to ensure with the US tariffs and the implications on the steel industry is that organizations really hold safety at the core of what they do during these trying times. We really can't afford to have employees lose jobs, come to work where they are worried, stress, financial stress, the implications of short time, less resources, budget cuts when it comes to safety. At the end of the day, it's, you know, they're the most important asset in these organizations and the sustainability of these organizations.
Do we have any way out of this crisis?
Yeah, I think there's definitely hope if we can ensure that...
Get your monthly essential products for just $599 at USAID. 10 kilogram each of Sugar King White Sugar, Top Score Super Maize Meal, and the Buck Prophet Cook Flour. Also 5 kilos Rice King as well as 500 grams Pasta King Pasta. All 5 products for only $599. You save. I save. Yes, we all save at USAID.
To organizations during these trying times, it will actually save organizations money in terms of not having to further exacerbate conditions from a financial perspective. So if we ensure that we make sure that the employees are safe, there's less cost spent on accidents, there's less downtime as a result of incidents. So there is a potential in terms of saving companies money during these times if we make sure that we look after their health and safety, look after them both physically and also psychologically because of the stress that the economy is likely to have on our employees.
We understand that this is the first leg of the conference that you guys are going to be having in the country. How many conferences are you guys going to be having and where?
So RAND Mutual Assurance is having 5 prevention conferences, our health, safety and wellness conference. We start today in KZN. We will be in Vereeniging on Tuesday next week, and then we move across to Gqeberha on the 18th of September. We go to Paarl in the Western Cape on the 30th of September, and then in Dullstroom in Mpumalanga on the 9th of October.
What is the main purpose of these conferences around the country?
The main purpose is to make sure that organizations remember the importance of health, safety, and wellness. We can have all the amazing systems in place, but organizations have to make sure legally, morally, and ethically that health and safety is taken a priority in organizations.
Thanks, Doc, for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
The National Treasury in South Africa welcomes progress in its smart meter rollout.
The smart meter grant project was introduced for the first time in the 2024-2025 budget with an allocation of 2 billion rand, targeting 71 municipalities in 3 years. By installing the smart meters, the aim is to improve revenue collection, reduce electricity losses, and give consumers real-time data on usage, empowering them to manage their own consumption more effectively. Sadesh Ramchandan is the Director of Local Government at the National Treasury and says the program is already showing positive results with 18 municipalities covered in the first year.
The municipality that is under intervention is Inokajima, the Eastern Cape. The 8 municipalities that we targeted last year was Bela Bela, Modimole, Mokopong, Makana, Salt Plaiki. The 2 municipalities that we went into detail is Salt Plaiki and Bela Bela. And we could see that the installation of the smart meter in these spaces have helped these municipalities with payment to Eskom. And these municipalities have also received the 1/3 write-off for good performance, the 1/3 debt write-off.
The National Treasury is looking to expand the program this year, bringing more municipalities on board and expanding the scope.
We've only targeted single-phase electricity meters in households. We've changed the framework in DORA in this current year to include water meters, include single-phase electricity, three-phase electricity, as well as CT meters. We also have realized that targeting the three-phase and the large power users within the municipal space is also a bigger benefit because they may be the bigger culprits in the space of municipalities.
500 million rand was spent in 2024-2025 for 8 municipalities, while 650 million rand is targeted for the second year, with 800 million rand in the final year. The money is an indirect grant paid to service providers, not the municipalities directly.
We implement in the space of the municipality, but we pay the service providers directly. The 7 service providers are Vodacom, MTN, CGCell, Landisangria, Isandiso, African Metering Solutions, and Conlog.
As the project moves into the second phase, the National Treasury says it has not been a smooth sail in some municipalities, with resistance from community members.
We found that some municipalities have been very poor at doing the proper consultation. And then once the installation started, the service providers experienced resistance from the community. So in this current year, we've made a conscious decision that there's a few pre-installation activities that need to take place. And one of them is to make sure that there's a proper public consultation. And I think it dovetailed with the budget process and the budget consultation in the municipalities, so that when we go out and roll these smart metering, we don't have the resistance.
Community members have been urged to rally behind the project as the country looks to modernize electricity management in the coming years, with 11 municipalities targeted for the next phase, including Endumeni, Inok Mgijima, and Gauteng's Mogale City. Katlego Lerodi, SABC News in Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, Zambia's cabinet has approved an SME bill to tackle sector challenges.
Small and medium enterprises are key to Zambia's economy. They make up about 97% of businesses and provide nearly 88% of jobs. But the sector still faces many challenges. Minister of Small and Medium Enterprises Elias Mwanga has met with business owners to discuss these issues.
The compliance requirements, they are suitable for big companies, big businesses, but they are disadvantaging the small businesses.
The biggest problem we're also facing is these properties being charged in USD dollars. It's a headache. You don't know how much you'll pay next month because you can't control the market. And then if the forex markets just rise, it's a big headache for a business owner.
Businessman Johnson Luo says high costs and complicated regulations remain a major problem.
You find that some of the things that the council are asking for, you find that other government departments are also asking for the same. Why can't we have a framework that narrows down these things and put them under one scheme?
Mr. Mwanga assured SMEs that government is working to address these concerns.
We've already started engaging with the local government over the fees that you are talking about. Cabinet has also approved the SME bill. The bill, it's now open to you, and I'm happy you are here. Some of the things that you've given out today, you've talked about today, you've given us today, they'll be addressed in the SME bill.
The minister also urged the business owners to familiarize themselves with the National SMEs policy, which offers incentives and frameworks to support growth and sustainability. Lucky Piri, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
Meanwhile, members of parliament raise a red flag over endless loans to finance projects. That's in Uganda.
As of mid-2025, Uganda's debt burden stood between shillings 106 and shillings 110 trillion, which is more than 55% of the country's GDP, as per the 2025 Midterm Auditor General's report. As MPs today returned from recess, the Ministry of Finance tabled 3 fresh proposals. to borrow 9.4 million euros and $36.5 million for the construction of cancer centers in Mbale and Arua. Another loan request is worth $99.56 million to finance a resilient livestock value chain project, and additional financing of 188.8 million euros and 28.31 million euros for the Busega MPG Expressway.
I beg to lay on table the proposal to borrow up to euros 188.18 million an equivalent of UA 150 million from the African Development Bank, and euro 28.31 million equivalent to UA 22.57 million from the African Development Fund as additional financing for the construction of Segampiji Expressway project. I beg to lay.
Speaker of Parliament Anita Among directed the Committee on National Economy to urgently scrutinize the livestock value chain and expressway loans, warning that delays could trigger cancellation since both projects are already in the pipeline.
The deadline of signing this loan is on 12th September 2025, but because we've been on recess, shuttle recess, we could not accommodate it, and failure to have it processed before that would call for a cancellation of this loan, and it has an aspect of a grant. I want to request the Committee of National Economy that you consider this loan and report back on Tuesday.
But while the government insists these loans are necessary to drive infrastructure and health improvements, critical voices in the House disagreed. Some MPs warn that continued heavy borrowing will push the country into financial distress, especially given the rising cost of debt servicing.
Last financial year, we had a budget of 70 trillion again, but we had a debt that had matured of 38 trillion. 48% of the budget was for debt servicing. This financial year, budget of 72 trillion, 27 trillion is for debt servicing. Yet the projection, tax projection is 34, but they will not collect more than 27. So these guys have mortgaged all of us, and the MPs are just nodding. Because I ask them before you say I, understand the implications.
The only thing is that our public debt will continue to escalate. And so we basically need to be thinking and say, okay, as we add more debt onto the national debt, how are we going to manage it? Is it sustainable? That's the question that should be asked. And then the question is, are we going to put that money into productive use?
And as Uganda's debt burden continues to mount, the worry is no longer about borrowing for growth, but about borrowing merely to survive. With Parliament's loan approvals feeding what many now call a vicious cycle, critics warn that the nation risks working only to service debt, while development aspirations slip further out of reach. David Ijo, NTV at Parliament.
Liberty Kenya Holdings finalizes exit from Tanzanian market.
Liberty Kenya Holdings has completed its exit from Heritage Insurance Tanzania. Now, the move comes as the group is preparing to launch fully digital life insurance solutions as a first part of many other products that are aimed at trying to drive growth in a market where insurance penetration remains pretty low at around 3%, and trust in the insurance industry as a whole is still quite fragile. Earlier on, I spoke to Kieran Godden, who's now the group CEO at Liberty Kenya Holdings. We started our conversation by exploring the rationale for the sale of that insurance business in Tanzania.
So the core rationale was really around strategic focus. So we're not retreating from different parts of the market. What we're doing is we're concentrating our strategic focus on Kenya. Yes, it freed up some capital, and to make our business more capital efficient, we returned that capital to the shareholders. So what that gave us was a more capital efficient business, which improves our return on equity, which is great for all of our shareholders. And obviously there was a cash payment into the shareholders, but the real change comes for us focusing on our core markets, and our core market being Kenya in this case, and which means that we can put more focus into things like getting our digital insurance platform launched.
Did all the proceeds from the sale go back to shareholders, or is some of that capital being deployed into things like what you said, you know, the digital insurance platform, building that up and scaling it out?
So we returned all of the capital we received from the Tanzania operation out to shareholders. So we fully returned it to shareholders. But that capital efficiency we gained is actually in an indirect way freed up other capital for us to invest. But we are investing our own capital. So we're not asking shareholders for more money. We're investing capital that we have into transforming our business into a more digital operation.
Looking at the half-year results, you pointed out that the Tanzania sale ended up with a commercial deficit of around 28 or so million shillings, relatively marginal. But was that because of the state of the business, the wider Tanzanian, the wider state, rather, of the Tanzanian economy? Or is it just, you know, a tough asset to sell in a comparatively tough market?
I think some of it was really just around the nuances of accounting. So there was some kind of technical accounting that needed to be done that led to that negative sort of appearing in the accounts. In the short term, the business did over the interim period, the business in Tanzania didn't make money, and we disclosed that, so it actually lost money over that period. But that's really a short-term problem. So whether it made money or lost money was not so much what we were worried about. What we were focusing on was the long-term strategy, which is around the focus into the core operating market.
Indeed. One of the things that you cited, you know, in talking about the decline in earnings, especially for the first half of 2025, were these higher claims coming through from general insurance, especially in a medical segment. Just speaking about it in a broader sense, though, looking at the data for last year, we saw medical insurance premiums for the industry as a whole go up by around 15% in the same year that SHA premiums kicked in. Are we seeing that growth continue in 2025 with individuals and companies saying, you know what, despite the high deductions for SHA, I'm going to stick with having this private medical insurance option?
The obvious is that it does create an opportunity. We are seeing medical continue to grow. We've seen medical continue to grow this year. We predict medical will continue to grow into the future. The two, I think, don't work opposite to one another. The state health insurance, or the SHA, and the private medical insurance complement one another. I think the most successful models around the world work on that basis. And also, that partnership actually works around the hospitals, around what benefits are covered. There will likely be some changes coming through the market in the future, but we still think medical insurance presents a great growth opportunity for the next few years.
How then do we tackle the loss ratio problem? Because looking at last year's data, again, across the industry, not specific to Liberty, but the loss ratio last year was around 78%, which was nearly 400 basis points higher than where it was in Q4 2021 in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. That number seems to go up year after year. What's going on with loss ratios in the medical insurance space?
I think there is a difference between what the industry data is showing and what we're seeing. So as you said earlier, our medical loss ratio has ticked up in this year. So we are seeing that. I think across the industry, what happens is there is competitive pressure on companies to keep their business. So what ends up happening is people might price lower than they should be to cover the risk that they have, which then leads back to that trust problem around claims not being paid. Because if you're underpricing your risk, you can't afford to cover it, then the claims loss ratio ticks up. If we think about 78%, it's probably on the extreme upper end of what should be happening in the medical insurance business. Once it starts going above that, I think companies who are running higher than 78, so anywhere in the 80s, possibly even the 90s, would be worried because they're burning their shareholders' money to provide the cover.
Experts weigh in on Kenya's coffee market outlook.
Still on agricultural commodities, let's turn to something you and I probably consume every day, coffee. Coffee exports in Kenya have gone off to a fairly strong start in the first 6 months of 2025. Between January and June, the country exported nearly 37,000 metric tons of coffee worth over $270 million. Export volumes and export earnings rose by 44% and 84% respectively compared to the same period a year earlier. In contrast to that, the tea market slumped in the first half of 2025. Export volumes are down by around 2% to just over 315,000 metric tons. Export earnings, however, fell by double digits, down 12% to just under $700 million in the same period. We'll explore that production glut there in a moment, but let's get back to coffee for the time being. It's important to put that rise in coffee export earnings into context. Since the start of the year, Arabica coffee futures in New York have gone up by nearly 30%. But Kenya's missed out on a windfall here in a massive way. Its coffee output has fallen dramatically from peaks of around 129,000 metric tons in 1988 to under 45,000 metric tons just last year. And that's not the entire story. Yields per hectare in 1988, they range from around 0.7 to 1.1 ton per hectare. At the moment, the national average yield is around 475 kilograms per hectare. So then, to explore developments in the coffee market and the issues plaguing coffee production in Kenya, I spoke to Martin Ocheng. He's the managing director of one of the large listed agricultural firms in Kenya, Sasini. I started our conversation by asking him if he thinks that this current price rally still has some ways to go.
We've seen the futures drop marginally in the last few months in terms of projections. So we expect it to drop slightly into the next season.
Given where Sasini is, you've got four main product lines, right? There's tea, there's coffee, there's macadamia nuts and avocados. Can you give us a rough sense of what the split is like in terms of revenue and profits between those four commodities and where coffee fits into that broader picture?
Yeah, it will be very rough because it varies from season to season. But generally, tea is our biggest business and has been traditionally for a long time. In a good year, when every crop is performing, tea contributes between 40 and 45% of our profits. We really don't worry about revenue because that's dictated by so many other things. The volume of the produce you have and the export of that volume. What really matters is the commodity price that year. And so what flows to the bottom line is really dictated, because the volumes tend to be stable, is really dictated by the returns that you get from a proceeds perspective in terms of pricing. So tea gives about 40 to 45%. Coffee gives us about 30%. And the other 30% is split between macadamia and avocado.
You've spoken about the quality edge that Kenyan coffee brings to the market. Now, in an environment like what we have now, we've spoken about the supply issues in Brazil and in Vietnam. But then we also have all of these other exogenous factors, exogenous shocks that come in, like the 50% tariff that's been slapped on Brazilian coffee. When the trade environment is as complicated, shall we say, as what we're seeing now with these sort of tariffs coming into effect, does that then have an impact on the price and the uptake of the product comes out of, say, Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda?
It will have an impact on the landing price in the U.S. if you're talking about the U.S. tariffs, so any country that is imposing tariffs on a source market for any of these commodities. So what happens is, if you load on to the normal cost of production and transport of produce into your market, other tariffs that are not originated from the production markets, then you're saying that those tariffs need to be transferred to the end consumers of those produces, of that product. And so, countries have the freedom to do what they want with how they import, how to protect their local farmers or local industries. But tariffs generally need to be thought through in a way that it doesn't affect the flow of goods and services, and especially goods for food consumption, into markets where they are needed. And so, you know, we haven't seen the effect of that yet. There's been a lot of talk around different markets being affected by different levels of tariffs from the U.S. government. We are working very closely through our client relationships in the U.S., but also through government bodies here to ensure that whatever has been traditionally going to the U.S. continues to go there.
And Kenya is facing a 10% tariff for its exports into the U.S. That's not going to eat into your margin, is it? Can you pass that along to your clients?
That's the goal. That's what we are working on. It's ideally, you don't want that to just be passed on to the producer, because in some cases, that's your whole margin. Mm-hmm. And so if you remove 10% from it, imagine then you start asking yourself why you're doing that business.
The tea side of the business, I know you flagged this in last year's annual report, and you know, you pointed out that there's been a surge of supply in the market, especially over the last 3 years from 2021 onwards, and that flipped the market in favor of buyers rather than producers like yourself. Is that still an ongoing problem, or are we making progress in trying to clear that glut of supply in the market?
There is progress. It's slow, though. So maybe to give you context, that the accumulation of tea from about 3 years ago, when the country instituted a minimum level of buying tea per kilo in terms of pricing in US dollars, meant that the buyers who couldn't pick up that tea at those elevated prices just didn't buy the tea. And so there was an accumulation from all the producers, especially the small-scale producers in the country.
Let us meet in Dakar for Africa Food Systems Forum.
The Africa Food Systems Forum is underway in Dakar, Senegal. Regional leaders, activists and economists are examining the obstacles hampering the development of agriculture on the continent. Beryl Oro brings us the details.
The Africa Food Systems Forum kicked off in Dakar on Monday with two presidents present for the opening ceremony, Senegalese President Diomaye Faye and Rwandan President Paul Kagame. The forum puts farming at the center of the continent's growing economies. Significant parts of Africa are becoming drier and weather more erratic due to human-driven climate change.
In the field of agriculture, the FSRP implements several types of climate-smart irrigation systems that are truly adapted to the climate, but also contribute to productivity, production, and the well-being of the communities affected. We are also involved in providing access to climate information and digitalization.
There's a continent-wide push for climate-smart agriculture to replace outdated farming practices. Organizations are working with governments to set up systems that can inform farmers about rain cycles and better planning.
Today, we believe that in West Africa, all producers should have real-time access to climate information. They should be able to find out and have access to the most useful information to determine the start date of their crop calendar, the date of the first sowings, etc. And with partners such as Anansim in Senegal and Anka in other countries, we have developed a digital platform to send SMS messages to targeted producers so that 2 or 3 days before the most useful information is available, producers can access it to prepare themselves, prepare their campaigns, and above all, know the nature or type of seed they will use.
The other core issue up for discussion during the forum is financing for smallholder farming. Smallholders who typically farm on less than an acre of land produce around 70% of Africa's food supply. But these 33 million farmers struggle to access land, equipment, and finance.
We are also working on what we call cost-sharing financing, because one of the main problems in agriculture and livestock farming is access to financing. In this regard, in addition to all our initiatives in terms of agricultural development, the FSRP provides a solution in terms of access to financing.
For partners present at the forum, such as Ireland, the question of focusing on the primary victims of climate change in agricultural support programs, namely women and children, will be a key topic for discussion. Ireland focuses 50% of its funding in Senegal on women farmers.
We work specifically across all our programs in Senegal especially to target 50% of women as recipients. So we, our global priority is to target the furthest behind first. And we know that a lot of the time the people most affected by climate change, by climate crisis are women and youth. So we try to integrate women and youth across all our programs. And in Senegal, we work in food security, agricultural security and climate resilient agriculture. And we target women in all of these areas.
For Senegal's strategic partners, such as the UN World Food Programme, the aim is to set up training programs that will enable young people to access jobs in the agricultural sector.
In Senegal, we have a partnership with the Mastercard Foundation to promote jobs for young people in the area of agriculture and food system. We are training young people in management, entrepreneuria and financial management to invest small activities in agriculture. And with this partnership with the MasterCard Foundation, last year we have trained 25,000 young people in Senegal in the area, different area of agribusiness, food transformation. And this year, the objective is to train 35,000 young people, mainly women.
The forum hopes to champion for policies and sustainable systems that will see Africa fully feed itself and feed the world. Beryl Oro, CGTN.
Israel steps up military offensive in Gaza City.
The Israeli government has rejected a new statement from Hamas saying it's ready for a comprehensive deal to end the Gaza war and free all Israeli hostages. It comes as Israel intensifies its military offensive in Gaza City. Across Gaza, hospitals said that by yesterday afternoon, at least 46 people had been killed by Israeli strikes, most in Gaza City. Let's speak to our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell. Yulan.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the... But before we do that, so let's just continue to listen to Israel steps up military offensive in Gaza City.
And just tell us more about what Israel has said and what was the proposal.
So the Israeli Prime Minister's office was quick to come out and dismiss this latest statement from Hamas, calling it more spin that contains nothing new, and saying that the war could end if all the hostages were returned and Israel's conditions, those set by its security cabinet, were met. They include the disarmament of Hamas and Gaza remaining under Israel's security control, also having a new civilian government that is neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority that governs parts of the occupied West Bank. Now, this was following a Hamas statement really reiterating its position. It said it was ready for a comprehensive deal that would return all of the hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners if there was an end to the war. And, you know, saying too that it wants this full withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, all of the crossings to be opened for aid to go in and for a reconstruction plan. And Hamas was really reacting to an earlier social media post by President Trump calling on it to immediately give back all 20 of the hostages who are still believed to be alive in Gaza. So I think what this really underlines is how stuck things are. We also had from the Israeli Prime Minister's office a video in which he really vilified the Israeli demonstrators who have been demanding a ceasefire to bring back the remaining hostages. He called them fascists, the Israeli Prime Minister, and he said they're vandalizing property, they're blocking roads, they're making millions of citizens miserable.
And what's happening on the offensive that's being pushed forward in Gaza City?
So there are some satellite images that people are commenting on today, which really show that already there has been this widespread destruction in neighborhoods around the edge of Gaza City. We've got a new report out from the UN's humanitarian office looking at what's happened in the past week. They add up figures from the Hamas-run Ministry of Health in Gaza that suggest 571 Palestinians have been killed across Gaza, many of those in Gaza City. They say
Onda karhandu yako parateza morwe data. Paife, ohandimo kuyadi. Nondaka, ne data, no shoyo o utungaraka mahupi. O netweka imwe, o kufutarumwe, o kuinyingarumwe, o kujapandali. Fio papa ndaoka. Onda pumga o netweka oyo haidira dira ya fange. O mafikwa amwe, ohandi streaming. O mafikwa amwe, ohandi popi. O mafikwa amwe, ohandi ningaishe poshikanto shimwe. Pamwina parateza, oinda holora, ameha ishipangere, osho, paumwini. Dira dira, omakota fanoni, data, momkaro wili, mwana parika, okutuma koutumaraka, okustreaminga, no kudenga pamwina parates. Konga, parates, Namibia. Always, always, okay.
And with that being said, we have now officially come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. To stay tuned for the Voters Education Program brought to you by Bishop Lucas Katenda. From Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful Thursday ahead.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months.